Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Each One Reach One radio show featuring Jackson Kaguri. Today we're joined by Mr. Kaguri, who is the 2012 CNN hero. Jackson was the founder of the Miaka AIDS Orphan School in his hometown of Nyakajeze, Uganda. Thank you for joining us, Jackson. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. Thank you for having me, Kwegu.
Certainly, certainly. Now, I recently read the story. Young man in 2007 walked 50 kilometers after hearing of a free school that had been established. Now, what did that story mean to you back then when you found out about the young man?
Kwaku, what that really brought to me was my own childhood, growing up in that area, walking many miles to go to school, walking many miles to visit my relatives, but to think of a young boy walking 50 miles just because he wanted to be in school, it touched my heart. It also inspired me that this young man didn't want to give up. He wanted something and he was determined to get it. And if there was anything I could do, and in this case I did, I had to do something for this determined young boy so he can get his dream, the dream of getting an education, just like I got a dream of getting my own education.
Certainly. So that led you to starting a school in his village. Now, going back to 2001, $5,000 had been saved up. You and your wife, young couple, ready to purchase a house. And then what happened?
So we just, any other young couple, you go through school, you graduate. Here we were, yeah, we wanted to get on with our American dream, buy a house. We had saved money to buy a house. Back home, each time we would go back in the past, we were met with all these children who were orphaned because of HIV and AIDS. Their parents had passed away. Their grandparents didn't have anything, a pencil, a pen, to provide them school. And looking in their eyes, and two of us who had both gone to wonderful schools and got education, we couldn't buy a house. We wanted to put up a school so these children could have opportunities to get an education, which is the only way for those children and for people in my village. It's the only way to break the cycle of poverty and deprivation. And so the $5,000 was an initial investment, not in the stock market, but in capital, human capital, investing in children. And it has been a wonderful investment with more than 1,000% return on it.
I can imagine. I'm sure it has. Now, you traveled the world, I guess, internationally speaking on behalf of children. Tell me, why do you believe so much in them?
Looking in the eyes of these children, I went to school in this village, and I had both parents alive at the time, and they are still alive today. To get an education for me, my parents had to sell cows, chickens, goats, and by the time I finished high school, Kweku, we didn't even have enough land to sell for me to complete high school. And that was in the 1970s. People were poor, but you still had your parents. For these children, they don't have a parent to invest in them. They don't belong to any home that even has chickens or goats. They have nothing. Their parents have passed away. Their grandparents had already sold everything to educate the parents. And here you have a child who is helpless, comp- completely. There is no hope, and that hope only hinges on 2 cents or a fifth of a pencil. And so for me, looking in their eyes and looking at the spirits, looking at their smiles, just like when I look at my biological son, Nicholas, all I can say to Nicholas is, I will take care of you no matter what. And so these children in the villages of Uganda, though their parents have died, when I look them in their eyes, I see the same thing that I see in my son's eye. Determination, love, they want love, they want to be cared for, but most importantly, somebody has to invest in their education, in their dreams. And so I cannot give up. They inspire me to keep moving. Each time I sit on a plane, each time I sit in a car to drive hours and hours to go on a speaking engagement, they are in the back of my head singing their songs and their eyes telling me, showing me, we need to be loved, we need to be cared for, and that's all we are providing for them.
Right. I understand you provide, I mean, not only the school, but meals, medicine. There's a whole slew of resources that you have there. How do you do it? You know, where do these funds kind of come from? It takes, I'm sure it's not cheap.
Oh, no, it's not cheap. This has been a project that has been going on for 11 years, but 11 years of individual support like you. When we met in Washington, D.C., you saw a group of people who gathered. We realized earlier on, just like how I used the example of my son, Nicholas, we don't just provide them education. These children need far more than just in-classroom mathematics, science, and reading. They have nothing. They are in a village that is so poor. There's no running water there. There's no electricity. In a typical fashion way, when you take a Western-based organization, those are starving children you would be seeing on TV. So what we do is take a holistic approach that not only looks at education, but looks at other obstacles these children face. Hunger. They have no food, so we provide them food. And we don't buy the food. The reason we can be able to afford the work we do is because on the ground in this village, the organization is owned by local people. Local people come and work in our farms. We have 17 acres of land that we have acquired over the years. We grow our food and feed these children 2 meals a day. We don't buy all this food. We grow it right there. We provide health care services, nurses who go in the villages and treat these children, but also treat people who live with them. We've collaborated with different organizations like Rotary International, provide clean water systems. We've worked with different other foundations to provide, to build a library so children have a book to sit down and read, just like I read to my son, I will read with him every day. We want these children to have an opportunity to read. We have worked with individuals to make sure the girls get sanitary products once they hit their puberty, make sure young boys have the basketball court where they can dribble a ball and learn what Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant and the Dream Team just did in Olympics.
Oh, right.
We have provided them opportunities on so many angles, but mainly meeting all the 5 basic needs: food, housing, healthcare, employment for older people, and shelter. And then we work with grandmothers in the homes. When you look at the cost, what we save by having these children live with grandmothers, whether they are related to this grandmother or not, the grandmothers are able to take them in, house them, and feed them if they have some food. If they don't, they come to our farm and get food to feed them at home. So it is a concerted effort by local people, by individuals like you, like me, who look at the situation and say we cannot wait for Bill Gates, for Oprah Winfrey, for a baseball player or NBA player to come and help us. We can provide a solution to a child for as little as $5. What you have is what we use, and we've been able to use it effectively, transparently, and that's the result of what you see in front of you.
I see, and in fact, you've been doing it an amazing job, a yeoman's job, in the last 11 years. I know there's organizations that have tried, I mean, huge international organizations, UN and you name it, who haven't been able to make the impact that your organization has made in Uganda. Now, I remember over dinner we were discussing, you said the first year, you thought you could really come in there and house and scoop a lot of these children, and the demand was overwhelming in that first year. You weren't quite prepared for what you saw. How was that in that first year?
Just like any of the issues we deal with, as human beings, we get overwhelmed by problems surrounding us. And looking at myself, just a graduate student, just finished Columbia University and went back to Uganda, I didn't have any money that many people have to put and solve a problem. Here we walk in a village thinking we are going to build a small school, 5,000, and we'll have at least 100 kids, and it will be all done. We walk in and we found out there is more than 5,000 orphans who are in need of school. And there and then I looked at my wife, she looks at me, and we go, oh my God, what are we going to do? But at that moment, sitting down with the elders, we decided we were going to look at one child at a time. And the few that we will look at, we will make sure we provide them quality education and a quality service. Not be bothered by the big numbers, make sure the ones we get have quality service. And that's what we've done. We've taken in the poorest of the poor. And the poorest of the poor, really, in my village, everyone is poor. So if you and I walk in there, we cannot identify who is poorer. And so we rely on the local people, local elders, local retired teachers, local church leaders, because our school is non-denominational. It takes in anybody. And they look at Jackson's nephews are orphans, but they have Jackson who can help them. But there is another orphan who lives with an 85-year-old woman. That orphan will come to our Nyaka school before Jackson's nephews come in. So we've taken the poorest of the poor, and that's the criteria we've used. But it has something also to do with faith, Kweku. When people are so poor, and I was raised in this community, all we focused on is God help us. And so with faith, the determination, knowing God will provide no matter what, is something else that has moved me through the obstacles and through doubts and overwhelming situations.
Absolutely. Now, I remember the story also you told about your father, and he's sending all of you to school, and he didn't have much. And what did he do? He said break up his pencils into five. If people don't understand what I'm saying, one pencil where he would snap it into five different sections and give one for each kid to attend school. So what did that mean to you? What did that signal to you as a young boy?
Somebody believed in me. Somebody believing in me, but also really growing up in that village, you didn't have comparisons whether somebody is rich or poor. Everyone was poor. And in those days, 1974 precisely, when I started school, I was very young, and I was determined to go to school because being the youngest child, my sisters were going to school, my brother was already in high school, And here we were here in the morning, Dad would line us up and cut one pencil with a machete. Cut one pencil 5 times. As long as you had that assist of a pencil in your hands, the teacher would never send you home. But if you showed up to school and your parents haven't paid tuition or have paid tuition and you don't have a pencil, you had to be sent home. So to me, that assist of a pencil represented everything I needed to get through school. And like I said, in D.C., the amazing thing and sad thing is today children are still dropping out of school because they can't afford assist of a pencil. And when people realize that, when listeners who are on this call realize that, a young man who is going in high school or somebody who is in college, and you look in your house, you have so many pencils. Have so many opportunities. There is a library across the corner. There is a bus that picks you and takes you to school. You look at those children who have to walk 15 miles every day to go to school and come back, and their education depends on a pencil. When people realize that, everyone realizes they can make a difference in somebody's life. If all it takes is a fifth of a pencil, Kweku, my friend, who cannot afford a fifth of a pencil in the United States?
Absolutely. It goes without saying. I mean, that people should be doing more in their community, but also think globally, because we all are interconnected.
Yes.
At the end of the day. Now, your book has, the Price of Stones, School for My Village, has become a New York Times bestseller. Recently, and you've also been awarded a 2012 CNN Hero. Of course, you're a hero to many already, but as growing up, who were some of your heroes and who are the people that you looked up to?
You know, the biggest hero in my village, really, growing up, you are surrounded by these determined people who are surviving in the harshest conditions. I had a teacher who was my biggest hero. You know, waking up in the morning and you go in a classroom, you have some, like 50 children, but somebody looks at you and keeps telling you, I have high hopes in you. You're going to be a wonderful person in the future. This teacher believed in me. She knew the circumstances I was living in. She knew my dad, she knew my mom. All these upheavals when my mom would leave home because dad was so abusive and she would leave home. This woman would sit me at break time when all children are running around and pull me back in the classroom and look me in the eye and say, look, you have to be determined and continued to study and continue in school. And she said to me one day when you are a man, all this will be forgotten and you'll take good care of your mother. Freda was my hero. I had several other people growing up. Of course, they change as you grow up. But when I look back now, these grandmothers, with their wisdom, these children who suffer every day, they are the true heroes. I wish CNN could go back and film them every week and bring a story of each of them, story of determination, story of resilience, story of living without barely anything. We complain so much about so many things. You get a car and you want the most expensive one. You buy a house and you want the bigger house. Where people are living on bare bones every day, have no blanket and bed sheet. People don't have to make a choice what they're going to wear that morning. Those are my true heroes. And I draw my inspiration from the circumstances they live in. When I'm discouraged anytime, Kweku, all I have to do is fire up my computer, look at the pictures of the children and the grandmothers they live with, and the day passes by just like that, and I'll ask 100 people to support Nyaka that day because they inspire me and I want to see their lives change.
All right, absolutely. I can't agree with you more. Oftentimes, you know, people, we look at our circumstance over here, or whether it's here or in Africa, but have more privilege than those that don't have that. We have to, you know, remind ourselves that, you know, a lot of people don't have, you know, even the slot opportunity that we've been given. So it's a very important thing that you say there. Now, these grandmothers that you support, I mean, without these resources, I mean, kind of what would happen to that family structure in your village there?
It would be broken families, because, like I described, when these grandmothers, when I was growing up, they were all working so hard to make sure their own children get an education. In some homes, these grandmothers have lost like 9 of their children.
Wow.
9 of their children, mostly, they were children who these grandmothers had educated on pennies, on 50 of the pencil. Cutting a pencil 5 times was not only my dad's making, it was the whole village. That's how everyone came to school with a fifth of a pencil, because they knew if they gave you the whole pencil, even if they could afford it, and you lose it, tomorrow you have to buy another one. So it was also a saving scheme for the village. So these grandmothers had already invested everything they owned in their own children. And now when HIV and AIDS and wars and malaria and preventable diseases started killing this generation of men, including my brother and my sister, these grandmothers lost their capital. They had invested in their children, thinking, hoping, wishing they would come back and take care of them. Now, that generation is wiped out, but that generation left orphans. Uganda has 2.2 million children who are orphaned.
Wow.
And these grandmothers are there overwhelmed. First of all, they didn't grieve their own children who passed away. But second, now they have more children to take care of. Only they have no assets left in their households. And
wow.
So for us, looking at the family like that is broken. The grandmother is depressed. The children are being recruited to go and be prostitutes and to go and work in child labor factories. Others are just working for food. They have no clothing. They have no water to drink. They have no utensils in the household. So really what we are doing is rebuilding a community from scratch. Even if the grandmother is not related to a child who lives in the home, she looks at that child and says, I will take care of you. My own children died, but here is another generation that's going to rebuild this village. And so we go back to buying a plastic cup so they can drink water. We've gotten a grant in the past where we've gone in and built small huts, but covered with now iron sheets, so they don't have to live in a house that is leaking every time it rains. We go back to making sure they have chickens in the homes using the Haifa Project approach, which is why Haifa also selected me as a hero in 2011. Because Haifa does not reach in our community, we use their approach to give chickens, piglets, houses, small housing. But what we've also done, Kweku, is economically empower them. Some of them do beads, like Beads for Life, and baskets, which we buy as an organization from them. That way they have income and resell them here in the United States and all over the world and take money back and invest it in these women. 7,000 grandmothers, and we are still going, and with more support, definitely will help more.
Well, you need to train some of the organizations here, Jackson, how to make an impact in the U.S.
It's interesting because Jeffrey Sachs was my professor at Columbia University, and when he started Millennium Villages, I have said to him, even when I spoke at United Nations, he was moderating our panel, and I told him, the Millennium Village program, it's like he took my idea and spread it on an international scale. Using millions of money to create one Millennium Village, and here we were with an impact. We have more than 34,500 children who live with 7,000 grandmothers, and we don't spend a million each year.
Wow.
But when you look at these Millennium Villages, each village is spending millions of money. When you look at the school Oprah started in South Africa, 40 million Academy of Leadership. Impact here, ours goes with cost effectiveness, with little money. So, yes, if you have those organizations that need to be trained, please let me know. We will offer them free services so they can change more lives in our African communities.
Of course. They definitely could use that. What is your hopes and ambitions for these children after they leave your school? I mean, your school runs up to primary 7, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
So what is the hope that, you know, will happen to them? I mean, do you hope they'll continue in your footsteps? Do you hope some of them will become maybe a doctor or a lawyer, or maybe send them to school here, to your alma mater, Columbia? Or
Our hopes, and this is very important, and I think it is also one reason our children have successfully passed their primary leaving exams to go into secondary school. Now, that's a wonderful statistic that your listeners will be interested in. In Uganda, the passing rate at that level is about 25% in public schools. When our students first graduated, the first class in 2008, 100% of our students passed. And they have passed 100% since 2008. The latest class is sitting the exams in November this year. And that is a staggering statistic because, as you remember, we choose them from the poorest of the poor. There's no criteria of being academically aware to come to our school. You have to be the poorest of the poor. So they are passing at 100%. Mainly because of the approach we take, the holistic approach. But the other thing we do to inspire them and to get them to focus, as soon as they come to school, we promise them we will take care of them until they have a qualification. So they are assured, just like without telling my own son, he knows Dad will be there for me no matter what. These children, the best assurance we can give them is we will be there for them. So when they graduate primary 7, we have a scholarship for each one of them. They have joined secondary schools for $500. The whole year, a young girl, a young boy is able to go to school, go to a boarding school. And now they are in the 12th grade. The original pioneers are in 12th grade. They are going to go in high school. We will pay for the high school. And when they go to university, we will place them in universities around the world, planting these seeds all over, knowing and assured that they will get involved in the organization and their communities no matter where they live. So they have that assurance. And yes, we'll be contacting Columbia, Michigan State, Indiana University, and we want also to have mentors like you. Many of our children want to be lawyers. So we want to pair them with lawyers so you can talk about what you want to do, but what does it take to do it? Medical doctors, engineers, cooks, teachers. Now we even have a gold medalist in Uganda. So we will be trying to get him to, if not to go there physically, he can record a message and send it to the children. So if they want to be marathon runners or sprinters, another Usain Bolt might come from Uganda.
Certainly, certainly. Thank you, thank you. Our time has come to an end, Jackson. Thank you for joining us on the show today. Our listeners can find out a lot more about your school by visiting the our website at nyakaschool.org. That's N-Y-A-K-A school.org. Purchase a copy of your book to read about more about your amazing story. Thanks, Jackson, and once again, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me, my brother. God bless you.
Certainly, God bless.
Okay, bye-bye.